it's time for another edition of the Perpetual Motion Machine weekly science program. I'm your host, Lincoln Tice, and this is the Perpetual Motion Machine for Thursday, January 5th, 2017. Today, we're going to be speaking about the complicated issue of bioethics. My guest today is Curtis Riles, a bioethicist who works in clinical ethics. He has a master's degree in bioethics from the UW Medical School.
Medical College of Wisconsin.
I'm sorry. We're going to be talking about a specific case study in bioethics, the story of Henrietta Lacks. This edition was inspired by the novel, by the book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, by the New York Times bestselling author Rebecca Skloot. I'm going to read a brief summary of the book from the cover here. Her name was Henrietta Lacks, but scientists know her as Hela. She was a poor southern tobacco farmer who worked the same land as her slave ancestors. Yet her cells, taken without her knowledge, became one of the most important tools in medicine. The first immortal human cells grown in culture, they are still alive today, though she has been dead for more than 60 years. If you could pile all Hela cells ever grown onto a scale, they'd weigh more than 50 million metric tons, as much as 100 Empire State Buildings. Hela cells were vital for developing the polio vaccine, uncovered secrets of cancer, viruses, and the atom bomb's effects, helped lead to important advances like in vitro fertilization, cloning, and gene mapping, and have been bought and sold by the billions. Yet Henrietta Lacks remains virtually unknown, buried in an unmarked grave. Now, Rebecca Skloot takes us on an extraordinary journey from the colored ward of Johns Hopkins Hospital in the 1950s to stark white laboratories with freezers full of Hela cells. From Henrietta's small, dying hometown of Clover, Virginia, a land of wooden slave quarters, faith healings, and voodoo, to East Baltimore today, where her children and grandchildren live and struggle with the legacy of her cells. Henrietta's family did not learn of her immortality until more than 20 years after her death, when scientists investigating Hela began using her husband and children in research without informed consent. And though the cells had launched a multi-million-dollar industry that sells human biological materials, her family never saw any of the profits. As Rebecca Skloot so brilliantly shows, the story of the Lacks family, past and present, is inextricably connected to the dark history of experimentation on African Americans, the birth of bioethics, and the legal battles over whether we control the stuff we are made of. Over the decade it took to uncover this story, Rebecca became enmeshed in the lives of the Lacks family, especially Henrietta's daughter Deborah, who was devastated to learn about her mother's cells. Deborah was consumed with questions. Had scientists cloned her mother? Had they killed her to harvest her cells? And if her mother was so important to medicine, why couldn't her children afford health insurance? So, that's quite the summary. Curtis, you've told me that this is a foundational case study in the modern field of bioethics. Why is that?
Well, I think this case is interesting for a lot of reasons. I mean, just reading that description, it kind of gives this notion of this incredible injustice that happened in the field of medicine. But at the same time, there's just incredible benefit that's come from it, at the same, you know, that has benefited humanity and really advanced the field of medicine. So on one hand, you have this what seems like this grave injustice, but on the other hand, you have this great benefit. And this case is unique in that it kind of compiles a lot of important topics in bioethics all into one case.
Yeah, so the backstory is that Henrietta Lacks, a poor black woman, died of cervical cancer, and without her knowledge, the tumor was then taken and the cells were cultured, as I understand. Is that correct?
Right, that's correct. So she went in and had surgery to remove, parts of the tumor, and then underwent treatment for that tumor. And she did agree to undergo the medical procedure, but what she didn't know is that they were going to take the cells from the tumor and try to cultivate them in the lab. And these cells were unique in that they were very rapidly growing, and they were the first cells that were ever able to be kept alive in the lab to continue growing from that point.
Wow, and 60 years from that point, they're still alive. They're still replicating, multiplying, being sold, and forming the foundation of one of the foundations of the modern biotech industry.
Yes, they're still around. I think, you know, they're obviously not the only cells being used anymore. There's biobanks everywhere and tissues being collected on a daily basis for, you know, medical advances. But these lines are unique in that, you know, it's the first cells that were ever able to be cultured, and they continue to be used for medical advancement.
Okay, so tell me a couple of the issues that the HeLa cell story brings to light about that are used in the modern field of bioethics.
Sure. So the biggest issue, I think, is that she didn't know that her cells were being collected, and furthermore, she didn't know what they would be used for in the future. So today, if somebody's going to collect tissue for research, they would get informed consent. And that's not just consent. That's not just you saying, okay, but it's informed consent, meaning that you understand the risks and you understand the benefits associated with that, so that you can actually decide whether or not you want your tissue to be used in that way for the future. And that can be difficult in certain circumstances when tissue is collected and frozen for future use down the line, and you don't really know what technological advances will come 10 years, 15 years, 20 years down the road, and how your tissue or cells might be used with those new technologies. So in some ways, to consent to future unspecified research, it's very difficult to really give an informed consent in that situation because you don't know how they're going to be used. And you can kind of see that in the context of these cells when they were collected. You know, first it was just a medical breakthrough to be able to culture these cells, you know, in a petri dish and keep them alive and continue to grow them. But then, you know, down the line they were used, as you said, for the polio vaccine, genetic research. The whole genome of those cells has been analyzed. And could you have really understood that in 1951, what the implications of using these cells for future research are? That's not very clear. But even if you were able to get a certain level of consent for these cells in 1951 and say, hey, we want to collect this tissue and use it for research, Henrietta Lacks came from an uneducated background. It would have been difficult for her to really understand the nature of what her cells were being used for. And you actually see that with her family once they did find out that her cells were being used, is they're very confused about what that meant. And it caused a lot of distress and, in some degree, harm to that family because they didn't really understand the implications of what it meant that their mother's cells were still being kept alive and used for future research.
Yeah, and it does seem like, you know, a very small fraction of the profits from these cells could be shared with the family, sort of, to compensate for that. To me, it seems like, you know, millions of dollars are being made. A little bit of that would probably go a long way. But you're saying that actually, courts are unsure whether people can sell. Am I using that right word?
No, I think the issue is, and I think the courts have been clear, and again, I'm not a legal scholar, so I can't tell you everything that the courts have decided, but I think they've decided that once, you know, the tissue leaves your body, whether it's blood or cancer tissue or whatever it is, you no longer have a proprietary interest in those cells. So today what you would usually see when people collect tissue for research purposes is a clause stating that if any commercial products are developed from this tissue, that you're not expected to profit. But there are cases where individuals have been compensated for donating their tissue to science. And that's either in the form of a one-time compensation, say, hey, here's, you know, $100 for your time and discomfort that you underwent. But there's also cases where people have actually had unique sorts of features about their cells where they've been able to continuously donate through their lives and actually make a living off of those donations. And so when you take that into consideration, with Henrietta Lacks, you wonder, well, since her cells were so unique and so rapidly reproducing, could there have been monetary benefits that either her or her family could have reaped if she were given the proper informed consent at the time of collection? But interestingly, so Johns Hopkins University, which collected the tissues, they have not sold the cells at all. I mean, they've given away for scientific purposes, but then it's down the line, people have developed those into, you know, commercial lines that they've sold for a lot of profit. And so you're kind of looking at sort of this, individual protection versus kind of a greater good that it can bring to society.
Interesting. So what other issues can we learn from this case of the HeLa cells?
Well, you kind of bring up the issue, again, with whether or not people can profit off of their cells, the issue of justice. And as I mentioned, it seems like there's this grave injustice here, right? This family could barely afford basic medical care. They couldn't afford basic medical care. But yet, millions of dollars are being made off of their cells. So there just seems to be this great imbalance there. And the other aspect of it is that while these cells have been used to generate, massive medical breakthroughs, who is really benefiting from those breakthroughs, right? So once these new technologies have been developed by, at least in part by using these cells, it's then kind of brought into standard of care in the medical field, and it's really people who can afford that medical care that are able to benefit from that. While, the people who have donated those cells and are really sort of economically disadvantaged don't even see the benefits that they contributed to. So there's that sort of grave injustice there.
Absolutely.
And so along those lines, you have the fact that even if Henrietta were given the opportunity to provide informed consent, she is considered to be a vulnerable subject in research. That would be a term that would be used today. And that's somebody who doesn't necessarily have the education or the economic background to be free of coercion or exploitation in research. And so today there's protections in place to kind of make sure that people aren't exploited in those situations. But, when this kind of happened, even though the idea of informed consent was around, it didn't have the same level of protection that we have today.
I see. So how do you think we can resolve this case? Do you think there's anything that biotech companies can do to compensate the family, or at least make sure nothing like this ever happens again?
Well, I think that there are protections in place now to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And there are a lot of regulations and oversight that occurs now that really weren't in place then. But as far as how to resolve the case, that's not really something that we're going to solve over a conversation on the radio. It's obviously bigger than that, and it's complicated because I think one question you could ask is, given the benefits that have been obtained from these cells, is this something that you would do again?
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about that. What is the process that now the institutions have in place to prevent something like this happening again?
Sure. So there are, part of the problem too with these cells is that they weren't really de-identified. They're known as HeLa cells, which, for Henrietta Lacks, essentially contain her initials. But even beyond that, her identity was known and published and disclosed. And because of that, the identity of her family was disclosed and known. And once you do, genetic analysis on the sample, you're essentially doing genetic analysis on the family, and, it really impacts people who are still alive rather than just Henrietta Lacks who had passed. So today there's a lot more privacy protections in place. If research is going to be done on samples without consent, it's only from samples that are completely de-identified so that you can't identify the person who they're associated with. But ideally, prospectively, if you're going to do research, you would gain informed consent from the person. You would say, this is the research that we want to do. Here are the risks. Here are the benefits. Here's a risk to your reputation, your family, whatever it might be. This may impact your health insurance or your life insurance if we discover something strange and disclose that information. And so you would get the informed consent ahead of time. And then that research is usually reviewed by an oversight board that makes sure that things are that the risk-benefit ratio is appropriate and relatively safe.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. I understand now there are institutional review boards at universities that do research. How long have these sort of standards been in place? How long have these institutional review boards been around?
Well, it all really kind of started from the World War II era and the atrocities committed by the Nazis and the Japanese during that time, where you just see this horrendous research being done on human subjects and war crimes, essentially. And so that kind of led to the development of these ethical principles through the Belmont Report, which allowed sort of the basis for research oversight boards to develop through today. So that's kind of the origination of the modern bioethics field. And so you have kind of the basic principles which drive that is autonomy, which is essentially the idea that people have the right to participate in research or not. They have the right to direct their own lives as they see fit. And in order to do that, there's a notion of informed consent, as we've been talking about, which means that you understand the risks and benefits of what's happening and you agree to partake in them without coercion. And then you have the issue of justice, meaning that the risks and the benefits of the research are evenly distributed. So, another example that's kind of related to the Henrietta Lacks case in terms of the disproportionate risk versus benefits that you obtain is a lot of research done on drugs for HIV, where they would take very poor populations in Africa and do research on it, but those populations couldn't afford access to the drugs that were developed from that research. And so the drugs that were developed from that research were then brought to more affluent countries like the United States and then distributed where the wealth was, essentially. So you had people undergoing the risks to develop this research, and then the benefits from that research is distributed elsewhere. So that was very unjust, and that's kind of what you see in the Henrietta Lacks case. And so when you do research now, you want to make sure that the risks are evenly distributed and people have the access to those benefits, and the risks are evenly distributed as well.
Yeah, so you mentioned some examples, of terrible research that happened in other countries, but, this has definitely gone on in the U.S. too, here with the story of the HeLa cells, the Tuskegee experiments, of course. Mm-hmm. So when, how do you feel about the modern state of, bioethics standards, and for how long, in your view, have they sort of existed?
I'm sorry, can you clarify?
I mean, the HIV research that you mentioned, that was not all that long ago, right? That was 80s, 90s. So for how long have we had sort of these real concrete standards in place?
Well, I think since the 60s, really, but they've been growing ever since. And I think it's something that's in continual development. Just recently, there's been proposals to kind of revamp the whole system and try to make it more efficient and also kind of get to the heart of the protections that we want. Because with any type of regulation or protections that you have, it can get quite burdensome. And with the Henrietta Lacks cells, that's actually one of the arguments for not paying the people who contributed the tissue is that once you start putting in regulations and requirements along those lines, it makes research to be very burdensome. And so it gets to the point where it can be so burdensome, it stifles medical innovation and medical advancement. And when you have to go through a system where you're constantly worrying about how to distribute, that wealth, it becomes very difficult to do that versus, a very for-profit driven, medical industry, which for better or worse, that's how it works. So, in the context of today, I think it's constantly improving. And even though protections ideally are getting better and you're hashing out these issues as they come up and you're getting case studies and examples and setting precedent as you can move forward, it also becomes so nuanced and complicated that it becomes difficult to do that research. So there needs to be a balance there, I think, to sort of weigh those risks and benefits. And I think that's in the process of continually advancing.
Yeah, these are extremely controversial issues, especially here in Madison, the work that goes on. I know at the Primate Center is really controversial to a lot of people. And, you know, they always talk about the benefits, you know, that come to humans and that the animals are treated humanely. All that stuff. It's a very interesting field, for sure.
And it's a difficult topic, too, because, I mean, with ethics, I mean, you can't necessarily say there's no right or wrong answer, but it becomes complicated, especially once you get into certain issues. And you think about the Henrietta Lacks case, and you think, oh, this is so horrible, you know, the family should be compensated with all this money, the horrible things, she should have had informed consent. And I agree with that to a certain extent. But if you think about it in the terms of, what if Henrietta Lacks said, no, you can't use my tissue, you can't use my sample? And this is the first case where we saw rapidly dividing cells that were able to survive in a lab environment and, you know, be reproduced. And just think of all the breakthroughs that wouldn't have happened. Think of, you know, all the people who would have died or been disabled from polio, you know, among other things, right? So it's a balancing act, I think, and it becomes very difficult to kind of sort through some of those issues. And, you know, it's easy to focus on the negative aspects about what happened with Henrietta Lacks, but there's also a very huge positive side that happened with it. And so you kind of have this conflict between sort of, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number of people versus these principles of sort of protecting individual privacy and respecting the person. And you have sort of this principled approach to research that might go against sort of some of this greater good aspect, which people sort of inherently attribute to being ethical.
An interesting... interesting study that I learned about at UW that went on was the Harry Harlow experiments with monkeys in the 60s, I believe, where he separated infant monkeys from their mothers.
Oh, sure.
And found that they preferred just a fuzzy doll to one that would actually deliver milk. So these baby monkeys would actually choose to starve to death rather than, you know, snuggle up to a metal contraption, I guess.
Right.
You could say. So obviously extremely cruel and kind of mind-blowing that you would need to do these, you know, that in our culture you would have to do work like this to show the importance of mothers and sort of touching. But I always thought that was very interesting. Could you just briefly touch on a few other interesting cases in the field of bioethics that maybe some of our listeners might be interested if they're interested in this topic? Is there anything else that they could look into?
There's so many, it's hard to choose from. You know, I think you had mentioned the Tuskegee study, which is a very well-known study where they... purposely let patients, I believe they had syphilis, be observed without treatment for a long period of time to see the natural progression of the disease. And it was primarily a black population that they're studying this on, who are very uneducated and poor, very similar to the Henrietta Lacks case. And that wasn't that uncommon of a study to do during that time, and it had some medical importance to see, you know, how do these diseases progress naturally? Are they really harmful? But then once penicillin came around during that study, they continued to withhold treatment just to see the continued progression of this disease, and that's kind of where it became problematic. And it's easy to look at a lot of these cases in hindsight and say, you know, that was horrible, but in the context of the time, not that it justifies it or anything, but it's it puts a different spin on it than you're typically used to hearing from, you know, the 2020 hindsight. So the Tuskegee study is a really interesting one. You know, off the top of my head, I'm having a hard time picking out specific examples, but there are really a lot of fascinating examples in the field of bioethics. And if you are interested in that field, I suggest you look them up because, like I said, there's not always a right or wrong answer, and they're really brain teasers. You know, like, what would you do? What should you do? It's really difficult to figure that out sometimes.
No problem. Well, thank you so much, Curtis. It's been great to talk to you. Once again, our guest tonight was Curtis Riles. He's a local bioethicist who works in clinical ethics. This has been, once again, the Perpetual Notion Machine. Thanks for listening to our volunteer-produced show.